Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, wherever America has intervened, the outcome has been war, genocide, destruction and displacement. He added that the Israeli attacks on Lebanon, Syria, Gaza and the West Bank were all backed by the US, without whose support Israel would not be able to commit those crimes. The leader of the Islamic Revolution also recalled the 12-day imposed war against Iran, noting that the enemy's 20-year plan to wage a war faced defeat on the back of Iranian solidarity. He said even the critics of the establishment stood united against the enemy during the June war. The leader praised the unity as a source of national pride and power. Journalist and political commentator Eric Wahlberg joined us earlier to comment on the standpoint announced by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. He believes that Iran was willing to negotiate, but the Trump administration sabotaged negotiations.
But then Trump turned around and said no. So he plays back and forth. He'll say he dangles this idea of negotiations, hoping that he can gain advantage. That if Iran, for instance, in June, Iran did say that it was willing to negotiate, and then what he did was he sabotaged that immediately. So this is another case where he's hoping that Iran will show some weakness, and then he can move in and attack again. So this is perfidious, this kind of negotiating tactic. But that's the way Trump operates. He likes to terrorize and then dangle negotiations and then go for the kill. So this is really high stakes gambling is what he is. That's where he made his money, casinos. That's money laundering in his casinos. So he knows all about gambling.
The Israeli forces continue to violate the ceasefire agreement with Hamas in the Gaza Strip, killing more civilians and preventing entry of aid into the war-torn territory. According to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, thousands of internally displaced Gazans are still living without safe shelter as the cold weather approaches. We were earlier joined by our Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Musabbeh. He says the Israeli regime continues to breach the ceasefire agreement in what is seen as an effort to impose a new reality on the ground.
In Rafah City, the Israeli warplanes launched another wave of the destructive and war attacks against Al-Junaina Aya, which is located in the eastern side of Rafah City. In addition to that, the western side of the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly Al-Nusrat refugee camp, was hit and targeted by the Israeli naval forces. They have ordered the gunfire towards the makeshift tents of the Palestinian people. This means clearly that the Israeli regime is still ongoing with its policy of violating the ceasefire agreement. They are still trying to impose the new realities and facts on the ground by continuing their flagrant violations of the ceasefire agreement. And the clear message that the Palestinian people are getting right now is that despite the fact that they are talking about a ceasefire, but there is no real cessation of the Israeli brutalities and attacks, the people are still suffering from the lack and the shortage of the medical supplies they need in order to overcome their scars and wounds inflicted by the Israeli attacks and the Israeli measures against the Palestinian people. The patients, particularly the patients with the chronic diseases, are still facing also multiple hardships in having a significant access to their, as you know, medical care and treatment here in Gaza Strip.
Hamas has strongly slammed cold-blooded execution of two unarmed Palestinian youth in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin by Israeli forces, calling for unified resistance against the regime. Hamas said killing two unarmed Palestinian youth reveals the criminal mentality of Israel and its disregard for Palestinian lives in defiance of all laws and humanitarian norms. The movement added that this is not an isolated incident, but part of a systematic genocide and a desperate attempt by Israel to implement its annexation plans. Hamas affirmed that resistance is natural and legitimate response to the occupying regime's escalating crimes and aggression. It called on the international community to take urgent action to stop these field executions, which have become an official policy of Israel and are carried out without accountability. The statement was issued after Israeli forces killed two young Palestinians from point-blank range as they were leaving the house without posing any threat. The regime forces then abducted their bodies. Earlier, we talked to our West Bank correspondent, Naka Hamid, to get the latest updates on Israeli atrocities across the occupied territory. Let us take a listen.
Let me start from Jenin, where the Palestinian Ministry of Health announced the martyrdom of two Palestinian young men, Al-Muntasir Billah Mahmoud Qasim, 26 years old, and Yusuf Asasa, 37 years old, after being executed by the Israeli forces in the area of Jabal Abu Dhaif into the east of occupied Jenin. Later, the Israeli forces have detained both of their bodies and refused to hand them over towards the Palestinian side, despite that the video shows that those two Palestinians were clearly unarmed and imposed no threat whatsoever upon the Israeli forces that were raiding the area. But they were shot at point zero, and of course this is something that's quite shocking and raging because the Palestinians over here, as we are talking to many of the Palestinians over here in the streets, they are saying that it seems like there is no value for the Palestinian lives in the streets, unfortunately, because this is a very clear crime that has been committed in front of the entire world.
The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has raised the alarm about Israel's brutal attacks on Palestinians across the occupied West Bank. UNRWA says 32,000 Palestinians who were forcibly displaced from refugee camps in the northern West Bank are still unable to return home. UNRWA said residents of Jenin, Tol Karem and Nur Shams refugee camps are still barred from returning home after being driven out by the Israeli aggression in late January. It added that these areas, which were once full of life, have turned into ghost towns. UNRWA said Israel has conducted mass demolitions in those camps, targeting over 190 buildings in Jenin camp in March and June alone. It emphasized that such systematic destruction of Palestinians' homes violates international law and only serves to entrench long-term Israeli control over those camps. The organization called for immediate reconstruction efforts while urging Israel to allow displaced residents to return home. According to official Palestinian data, the Israeli aggression in the West Bank has killed more than 1,000 Palestinians, leaving nearly 11,000 others wounded since October 2023. The repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement continues unceasingly 2 years after the launch of Al-Aqsa Flood Operation. United Kingdom assigned the Palestine Action Group as terrorist. Austria is following suit. Several members of the Anti-Racist Solidarity Association, Dar al-Janoub, face similar terror charges for their activism. Our correspondent Dieter Reinisch reports from Vienna.
First came the media campaign, then the pressure from conservative politicians, threats against members and damage to their property. Now the Austrian state prepares terror charges against one of the most established anti-racist and anti-colonial organizations in the country, Dar al-Janoub. Among the accused is their current chairperson.
The situation was similar like the house raids against our association Dar al-Janoub in February. The house raids were supported by heavy force through the special unit Vega, and they came into my apartment and they confiscated laptops, telephones, documents from the association and also private books, for example a book from the 1980s in German language from Rassan Kanafani.
Following the raids, the activist lost his job and is now facing several charges for his political support of Palestine and anti-colonial struggle in the global south.
The state prosecutor accused us of membership of a criminal organization, membership of terrorist organizations, and also the we are people who force others to violent acts and terrorist acts.
The association had to close their premises due to the growing legal expenses. The activists face imprisonment of up to 10 years if charged. The Austrian government launched its crackdown on pro-Palestine protests and activists after October 7 in 2023. It imposed a ban on the first rally that was held after this date, but activists went ahead and held the rally, which resulted in the arrest of hundreds of them. Now, 2 years later, the court has announced its ruling on the legality of the ban.
The Constitutional Court has now ruled after 2 years that the ban on the demonstration was lawful. We will now appeal this decision to the European Court of Justice.
Legal experts say this harsh repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the past 2 years increasingly undermines democratic rights throughout Europe.
Gerade auch das Strafrecht immer mehr zu
criminal law is increasingly becoming a system of thought crime. This means that people are being reported and convicted because they hold a particular political opinion that is deemed illegitimate by the authorities. And I consider this a very dangerous development.
The European Palestine Solidarity Movement has faced unprecedented repression and discrimination in the past 2 years. Germany and Hungary are among the most repressive states, but Austria is taking even one step further, equating opposition to the Gaza genocide with terrorism. Dieter Reinisch from Vienna.
Venezuela has revoked operating rights for 6 major international airlines that had already suspended flights to the country. The airlines suspended flights after a warning by the U.S. aviation regulator about heightened military activity in the area. The move by Caracas came a few days after it warned the airlines to resume flights to the country within 48 hours or risk being stripped of their clearance to fly there altogether. The affected airlines are from Spain, Portugal, Turkey, and Colombia. Venezuela said in a statement that by unilaterally halting commercial flights to Caracas, those airlines had joined actions of state terrorism promoted by the U.S. It added that the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration has no jurisdiction over Venezuela's airspace. The new development came amid rising tensions between Caracas and Washington. The latest media reports indicated that the U.S. is preparing to launch a new phase of operations targeting Venezuela, which may include attempts to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. Earlier we talked to our correspondent Gladys Quesada to get an update on the rising tensions between Venezuela and the U.S. after Caracas revoked flight rights of 6 international airlines. Let us take a listen.
This decision came in the aftermath of this stopping by these airlines of granting and giving their services to the customers coming to Venezuela and going out from Venezuela. In any case, as the president and the other authorities have been stating, the U.S. does not have jurisdiction over the airspace of Venezuela, and this overlaps with other kind of operations on the side of the U.S. Let's recall that on Thursday night and on early morning on last Friday, the U.S. Conducted overflights on the airspace of several countries, 6 countries, adding Venezuela, so there was 7 countries under this kind of actions. And the U.S. is amassing not only the destroyers and the warships in the Caribbean, they are also amassing planes in Trinidad and Tobago. So all of this is, we need to have an overview of this kind of situation. It's not only that the U.S. is threatening Venezuela's economy and also attacking Venezuela's sovereignty, doing this kind of warnings against traveling, and also that the airlines are doing this unilaterally and encompassing the U.S. It's also that the U.S. is amassing this kind of resources, is amassing this kind of assets really, really close to Venezuela in Tobago.
In London, activists have held a rally outside the official residence of the British Prime Minister calling for urgent action over Sudan's escalating crisis, including atrocities in Darfur. Demonstrators accused the UK of complicity through its arms deals with the United Arab Emirates. Let us hear their voices.
The purpose of this demonstration is that our brothers and sisters in Sudan are getting genocided, they're getting killed, and the UAE and the UK government are complicit in this killing. The UK have been licensing arms to the UAE that they know it could end up very plausibly being used in the massacres and the genocide happening in Sudan. And the UAE and its investments and its deep roots in this country is also one of the reasons we're here, we're attacking and we're protesting against this.
Well, this demonstration is to put pressure on the UK government to do more to end the war in Sudan, specifically by ending ties with the UAE, stop selling arms to the UAE. The UK government has done very little to end the war. In fact, I would put to them that they are contributing to what's happening in Sudan.
The demands are generally three for this demonstration. The first is sanctions on the UAE for their support of the rapid support forces. The second is a total UAE arms embargo to prevent any UK-designed or UK-manufactured weapons from arriving in the UAE and being delivered to the rapid support forces. And then the last one would be a boycott of the UAE of all goods and services until the pressure causes them to stop supporting the rapid support forces.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kabita Hawaii. In today's program, we have the honor and pleasure of having with us Dr. Manoucher Motaki. If you're not familiar with Dr. Motaki, he was the former foreign minister of Iran during the time that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was in office. Now, he's very familiar with Iranian politics. He's been a fixture in it for quite some time. And one of the aspects that he's very familiar with is Iran's nuclear file, not only during the time when he was in office, but also given the recent developments that have happened in that file, of which we will discuss with him at length in this edition of the program. Dr. Motaki, welcome to Unscripted.
Pleasure being with you.
Thank you. Let's start off with, I don't know if you want to call it a celebration, but it's an end of a decade of what's called, what was called the JCPOA. Give us your thoughts as to what you think it represented, and now that it's over, where you see this file going, and what positives and negatives were entailed during the time it was in existence.
The JCPOA is yet another case initiated from the goodwill of Iranian officials. Negotiations lasted for 2 years, and now 10 years have passed since the agreement was reached. According to UN Security Council Resolution 2231, sanctions against Iran were supposed to be suspended after these 10 years. However, in practice, they not only have remained in place, but the United States' extraterritorial sanctions have even imposed harsher restrictions on Iran than those that existed before the deal. Iran's optimistic approach was short-lived, as it was met with a disproportionate response from the other parties. Despite Iran's full compliance with its obligations, The other sides, particularly the United States and the European Troika, refused to uphold theirs. The U.S. withdrew from the deal midway, and the European parties not only neglected their commitments to lift sanctions, but even went further by imposing new ones. For us, the JCPOA's most important promise was the lifting of sanctions after 10 years. While we do not celebrate this milestone, we honor the perseverance and resilience of the Iranian people in withstanding a decade of unjust sanctions. Last month marked the end of the JCPOA's 10-year term. I believe that the unlawful and unfair decision by the three European countries to trigger the snapback mechanism this time turned against them. For the first time in the history of the UN Security Council, a division emerged among its permanent members, those who, despite occasional differences, had generally maintained a unified stance on Iran's nuclear program. We saw China and Russia, together with Iran, condemning the European Troika's action as illegal and illegitimate. They formally expressed their objections in letters to the UN Secretary General and the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The Russian representative, who held the Security Council presidency at the time, articulated this position explicitly. So, from our perspective, the JCPOA has effectively come to an end. Now, what I propose is that, beyond our officials' acknowledgement of the deal's expiry, we should formally announce our withdrawal from it, as the agreement has brought us no tangible benefits. As we say in Persian, it is time to pull out this bad tooth that has brought us nothing but pain and loss. Such a step would also prevent the Europeans from exploiting the JCPOA as a means to exert further pressure on us. Therefore, I believe Iran should officially withdraw from the JCPOA, and after that, our peaceful nuclear activities, like those of any other normal country, will continue solely in accordance with safeguard obligations and under IAEA supervision.
Well, we have the Iranian Foreign Minister, Abbas Araghchi, who, in an interview very recently, again state that Iran will not negotiate its missile program. He said no sane person would accept its disarmament. He also said we cannot stop uranium enrichment, and also adding what cannot be gained through war cannot be gained through politics. When he says that, and when you state that we should enter a new framework of negotiations, how will this particular two non-negotiables be negotiated?
The Americans not only failed in the JCPOA, but also in their overall approach to negotiations. During Trump's first term, Washington called for talks with Iran while simultaneously imposing maximum pressure and harsh sanctions, a request that Iran firmly rejected. Even Trump's letter to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, delivered by the Japanese Prime Minister, was dismissed. Our leader made it clear that while he respects the Japanese Prime Minister as a friend, he does not accept Trump's message. In his second term, Trump again called for negotiations, but we had no reason to trust him, given America's record of broken promises. The United States has repeatedly tried to deceive its counterparts in negotiations. A lesson Iran has learned over the past 46 years, from the 1981 Algiers Accords to this day. We agreed to indirect talks with the U.S., but they turned out to be nothing but a cover for Israel's preparations to attack Iran. The U.S. itself admitted that it was aware of Israel's planned aggression. These negotiations were therefore a deception. Why should we negotiate with those whose only goal is to mislead us, especially when they push the talks into a dead end before they even begin? They claim to seek dialogue only to deny Iran its right to enrich uranium, a demand that is unlawful, illegitimate, and contrary to international law. As a member of the international community and a signatory to the NPT, Iran has the inherent right to enrichment. Who are they to tell us otherwise? No one has the authority to dictate that Iran cannot exercise this right. They have also claimed that Iran should be deprived of defensive capabilities. Today, any person, even a child, only by looking at what has occurred between Iran and Israel over the past 6 months, can tell that disarming Iran would simply give Israel a free hand to carry out more attacks. Would the United States ever agree to negotiate over its own defense capabilities? Iran holds a vital geopolitical and geostrategic position. This region is the heart of the world, the center of global energy and economy. In such a sensitive environment, should a country like Iran not be able to defend itself? Naturally, the United States has no right to interfere in this matter. So when the U.S. raises issues such as Iran's enrichment and missile programs, its true objective is to sabotage the negotiations. The leader of the Islamic Revolution emphasized the same point in his speech last month. Therefore, Iran will not engage in talks with the United States unless Washington first recognizes Iran's right to enrichment and self-defense. Only after such acknowledgement would Iran consider discussing other matters.
So if you were to take a comparative analysis during the time that you were foreign minister, in which you had a voice for the negotiations, given what we're looking at now, do you see there being any type of breakthrough?
ببینید من شخص البته بنده نظر شخصی خودم رو میدم من به عنوان یه نماینده مجلس.
Let me share my personal point of view. As a member of parliament, I see no necessity at this time to negotiate with the United States. There is nothing left that requires such negotiations. We believe that the Americans have no right to interfere in our internal affairs. Therefore, I see little chance that there will be any negotiations with the United States in the foreseeable future.
Let's go back to the question I want to ask is about Russia's role and even China's role in terms of Iran when it comes to its nuclear file. And now that we have experienced the 12-day aggression from the Israeli regime against Iran, the 12-day war, as some call it, we are seeing a much more active support, at least it appears that way, from Russia, also from China. Do you think that they are doing what they can to support Iran as much as is possible? Or do you see any restraints there? Do you see any impediment or any restrictions on their side to assist Iran, or can they do more?
Russia and China fully understand Iran's strategic significance. 40 years ago, when I headed the East Asia Department at the Foreign Ministry, the Chinese Foreign Minister, Mr. Wu Jian, paid a visit to Iran. It was the first such visit by a Chinese foreign minister. After his meeting with Iranian officials, as he prepared to depart, he told us that a strong Iran is in China's interest. Today, Russia wholeheartedly shares the same perspective, that an independent and powerful Iran serves the interests of its friends, both regionally and globally. Our relations with China and Russia have had ups and downs, but today they rest on mutual understanding, shared interests, and a common perception of current realities. These are strong foundations for a strategic partnership. Russia once avoided describing its ties with Iran as strategic, but now it announces it openly. China, likewise, considers Iran a strategic partner. While other energy suppliers to China may face disruptions under external pressure, Beijing understands that its energy cooperation with Iran will remain in place and benefit both nations. So we regard China and Russia as our natural and reliable partners. Regarding Iran's nuclear program, we have previously raised our concerns with both countries. During my time as foreign minister, I addressed this directly with Mr. Sergei Lavrov in a two-hour discussion. I explained that although Russia and China may refrain from proposing new resolutions against Iran at the UN Security Council, and often seek to moderate Western proposed drafts, our objection lies in the fact that they still vote in favor of those drafts. We had a very candid and constructive exchange on this matter with both the Russians and the Chinese. During one of my visits to China, I asked the foreign minister under what circumstances China would exercise its veto power at the Security Council. My point was that if China does not share the Western position on Iran's nuclear program, it should veto their proposed resolutions. Today, China and Russia have adopted such a stance. For the first time, and due to several factors, including their relations with Iran and the increasing hostility of the West and the United States, they have decided to bring more of their capacities into action. For example, they have stated that certain issues should now be handled within the Security Council framework, making it more difficult for Western states to pass resolutions unilaterally. Furthermore, under Resolution 2231, the Iran case has been completely removed from the Security Council's agenda, and the JCPOA has effectively come to an end. I therefore view China and Russia as playing a positive and constructive role, both in their relations with Iran and in broader international affairs. China is now the world's largest economy, and by 2030, it will overtake the United States and take the lead in the global economy. As for Russia, I believe that through prudent management, it will overcome its current challenges. The Ukraine issue will eventually be resolved. Even some recent U.S. statements indicate that Washington is adopting a more realistic view of the Ukraine issue, and we hope that this crisis will come to an end soon.
When it comes to Iran's relationship with not only China and Russia that we've been discussing, there's a certain impact that this 12-day aggression, Israeli 12-day aggression against Iran, has had in terms of the image that Iran has on the world stage when it comes to its military capability, the retaliation that Iran incurred on the Israeli regime. Tell us how that impacted the view coming from different countries since we saw the type of damage that Iran incurred on the Israeli regime.
After the Islamic Revolution, Iran's position toward Israel was clear. We believed that Palestinians had their lands occupied, their people displaced and killed, and their property seized, and that they must reclaim their rights. The reason the crisis in West Asia has persisted for 70 years is that its root cause has never been truly addressed. In this regard, we have put forward the most comprehensive political initiative. I'm referring to the idea of holding a referendum, though I will not go into its details here. What I want to emphasize is that, despite never recognizing Israel, Iran has not fired a single bullet toward the occupied territories in the past 46 years, because our military doctrine is purely defensive. It was the Zionist regime that first launched military aggression against Iran. They thought they were striking at the most opportune moment. They assumed Iran's economic challenges and public dissatisfaction would make it vulnerable, and that eliminating Iran's military and political commanders would turn the people against the Islamic Republic, leading to its collapse. This was part of Netanyahu's long-term strategy to confront Iran, a plan he ultimately set into motion. For comparison, in any other country, the assassination of top military commanders could cripple the armed forces and potentially bring down the state. Such scenario, if followed by a public unrest, would accelerate the system's collapse. This was how the Israelis expected the war to unfold. Yet, on the second and third days of the war, more than a million people took to the streets of Tehran to express support for their country and armed forces. Israel had expected mass protests against the Islamic Republic. Instead, Iranians from all walks of life, of every age, profession, and background, came out in unity to defend their nation and government. By the third day, it had become evident that Israel would not win the war. By the eighth and ninth days, the Americans had realized Israel was facing a defeat. Consequently, on the 11th and 12th days, they decided to propose a ceasefire. In the eyes of global public opinion, Iran emerged as the victor of that war. Today, Netanyahu is widely regarded as the loser of the 12-day war, a reality that continues to trouble him. This is why the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs keeps giving interviews and issues threats of new attacks on Iran, merely to appease public opinion in the occupied territories. People there are saying that, just as the former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was forced to resign after losing the 33-day war with Lebanon, Netanyahu should step down too. To delay such calls, he speaks of launching another offensive. However, those who supported the previous war against Iran are now hesitant, fearing another defeat. Thus, the confrontation between Israel and Iran has become a powerful source of inspiration for the resistance.
We've reached the end of this interview, and I'd like to extend the thought of how you mentioned, which is very obvious, Iranians to have come out and rallied, as they say, around the flag when Israel executed its illegal aggression against Iran. We saw how that actually transpired, and the fact that Israel, the Israeli regime, every so often says that, you know, we're not done with Iran, we may attack Iran again. The Iranians want to leave this box that they're in, this uncertainty. So they feel like, well, the onus is now on the Iranian government to move out of this sphere into a future that's filled with optimism. How would you direct that, in your view, for the Iranian government to move forward and make Iranians happy in terms of their future?
من در کمیسیون اقتصادی مجلس هستم.
I currently serve as the Parliament's Economic Commission, unlike my previous two terms when I was a member of the National Security Commission. The reason for this change is that our country is now facing serious economic challenges that must be effectively managed. We need a profound transformation in the structure of government and in the framework of our economic system. We are a rich nation, yet our governments are poor, largely because they're oversized and costly. Today, around the world, governments are becoming smaller while economies grow larger. In Iran, the opposite is true. We have a large government and a small economy. In Parliament, we are working with fellow representatives and the administration to design a balanced model that will streamline the government and strengthen the economy. This is one of the most important ways to enhance public satisfaction and rebuild people's trust in the government and the system. Iran is also an ancient civilization. I remember when Austria's Minister of Agriculture visited Iran in the 1980s, he said to us, "When we in Europe were still living on trees, you already had civilization." He was referring to the Viking era. Such is the depth and continuity of Iran's heritage. The Iranian people have a recorded history stretching back 10,000 years. Throughout history, many have tried to destroy Iran, yet they were ultimately absorbed by its culture and civilization, and it was Iran's culture and spirit that prevailed. The Iranian people take great pride in this legacy, and we officials are honored to serve such a nation. I believe that the bond between the people and their government is deep, spiritual, and enduring. We are fully capable of solving our problems, God willingly. In foreign policy, too, our position is clear. We reject the language of coercion. We believe that the law of the jungle is over. Nations must engage with one another on the basis of law, justice, and fairness. We neither impose our will on others, nor do we accept coercion from anyone. This conviction is rooted in our faith and in our holy book, the Quran, and it forms the cornerstone of our foreign policy.
Very well, thank you so much. We're going to end it on that note. It was a pleasure to have you, Dr. Motaki, here in the studio with us, and we were enlightened by the statements you made, especially towards the end there when you talked about Iran's economy and, of course, all the other topics. Thank you so much.
I thank you very much. It was a great pleasure for me being with you, my good brother.
Thank you so much. Well, that does it for this edition of Unscripted. You heard Dr. Motaki. Many topics were covered by him. And it's very interesting the way that he talks about the foreign policy, as you just heard, in terms of at least Iran's approach. From Mikhail Tavli and the team here at Unscripted, it's goodbye.
Trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in tried all is it. Is there any way left to save me? I need someone from the heavens who can heal my soul and not just my body. I need someone from the heavens who can make me free and not just hide. Small pills and push me to sleep, but you can't change my dreams, they're too deep. You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Thank you.
researchers' work quietly shapes the future of how machines see and understand the world. They bridge the gap between abstract algorithms and real-world applications, pushing boundaries in fields like deep learning, computer vision, and intelligent document processing. My guest today is one such innovator, an academic and practitioner whose contributions span both cutting-edge research and impactful industry collaborations. With a passion for pattern recognition and a commitment to advancing AI education, he continues to inspire the next generation of scientists and engineers. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Ray. Yusri Kesentini is an associate professor at the Digital Research Center of ESFAX in Tunisia, where he leads the Deep Vision research team. With a PhD in pattern recognition from the University of Rouen, France, and an engineering degree from the National Engineering School of ESFAX, his work centers on deep learning, computer vision, and document image processing. He has authored over 60 publications and actively collaborates with industry on technology transfer projects. Dr. Yusri Kesentini, very good to have you on this program.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm honored to be with you today. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure, actually, to have you here in Iran as well. What are some, if you are going to mention some key milestones or breakthroughs you have achieved in document image processing?
Yeah, I participate in many competition, international competition. For example, in my PhD, I have participated in a competition on Arabic handwriting, Arabic recognition, and I have I was ranked in top three, I think, with my system. Giving that participant is of high level. There is Google. There is some big company.
From the time that you were a student, or is it after you had come back to Tunisia?
No, this is was in my PhD, when I conduct my PhD. And now we continue to work, for example, in named entity information extraction from documents. So we have also participated in a challenge how to extract some information from records, marriage records, for example, historical marriage records. Yeah. And here there is a transcription stage, and we need to combine with NLP, natural language processing techniques, to understand the text and extract some named entity, like name of person, locations, dates. Here also we are ranked in top one in this competition. We have some interesting for document enhancement. Also, we compare our result using generative artificial intelligence. We have working with GAN, generative adversarial networks, diffusion models, and we have very good results that are compared to the best results in the world in these applications.
And have you ever, your research, has it ever involved AI and translation? Because that's also my field, and I want to know.
Yeah, we don't work on translation, but translation, I think, can be as a post-processing after the transcription. If we get the text, we can after use some NLP tools to transcribe the model to other the output, the text, or to other language.
So it would be a good idea to work on that together.
Yeah.
I'm trying to steal you and your expertise for my own studies. Very good. And tell me something. How did you begin working with industry partners on technology transfer projects?
Yeah, this is the idea of our research center. When we create our research center, because before in Tunisia, most research laboratory work just to publish the result of their PhD in some conference, some journals. But we take a decision in our research center that we think that research must impact our socio-economical environment. And we start, this is a strategy that we have adopted, that we need to collaborate with companies to do this. And we started In the beginning, it was difficult because it is not common to collaborate between researcher and company. So the first project was difficult to convince the partner to work on with the researcher on this kind. But after, when they see the success of the project, and it become more easy. And now we have many, many projects with company because we are now known that our disaster center work with high quality with company. So it is more easy to be involved in this kind of projects.
So you kind of provided the industry with the missing link so that you kind of facilitated future research.
Exactly.
That's very interesting, Doctor. Yeah, very good. And of course, it's a pleasure to have you here because you were part of the, as I said, the sixth edition of Mustafa Prize. The scientists from all over the Islamic world get together every year. And that's a pleasure to have you as one of them here on SOAP and our show.
Thank you.
Very good. Tell me something. What do you enjoy most about mentoring students?
Yeah. It's a good work, I think. I like it because sometimes we have some students, some PhD students that come without any knowledge in artificial intelligence, in document images, and we need to coach them to have sometimes many skills to conduct their PhD. Our goal in the Digital Research Center is not only to publish. It's the most important is not the quantity of how many publications, but the quality. So we try to publish in high quality conference and journals. So there is a ranking of conference and review. Most of our publication are in Q1 journals, ranked journals, and A-class conference. So we try to improve the quality. And this is amazing because you see how the PhD student improve his skills month after month. For the supervisor is a great result also. When my PhD student come to his end of the PhD, it is a pleasure for me also because I see the results of works of how many years concretize it in this day.
And it basically becomes part of your journey.
Yeah.
And of course, your research center has had so many collaborations with commercial applications. Can you name some of the most important, significant examples of those?
Yeah. In the Deep Vision team, we work on document image, but not only document image. So we work on different multimedia data. So we work on satellite images. This is in the context of smart agriculture. So we work on monitoring of olive tree in Tunisia, because Tunisia is very famous by olive tree. We have large crops of olive tree.
Black and green?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we are the third producer of oil, olive oil, in the world, in Tunisia. So we need to provide some artificial intelligence tools for monitoring these crops, for detect some disease, for to control irrigation. So this is also part of our works. We work also on scene images in context of video surveillance, for example, how to detect persons, how to detect license plate in the vehicle, in Tunisian vehicle, and recognize them after. So we have many, many projects in these different application of images.
Very pragmatic.
Yeah.
They are, of course. And, of course, how has your role as an NVIDIA DLI instructor and an ambassador shaped your outreach efforts?
Yeah. I'm NVIDIA instructor and ambassador since 2018.
Okay.
To be instructor, there is many steps that you need to conduct with NVIDIA to be sure that you have the skills to be an instructor. And as an instructor, I deliver many training sessions for student, for academic, for industrial also in Tunisia. It is a training session, generally of today, on different topic of artificial intelligence. It is a certified training. So it means we use a platform of NVIDIA. All the work is in the cloud of NVIDIA. And the final step, there is an assessment that participant must conduct to get their certificate. So. This is the goal of
Right. Well, Dr. Yusri Kesantini, I wanted to continue the conversation, but I got the cue that we have to end because of time. Like to really thank you for being with us, but towards the end of the show you always get like a couple of minutes to talk directly to our audience, so for these 1 or 2 minutes our audience are going to become yours.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very happy to be with you in Iran. It is a very interesting opportunity to participate to the Mostafa Awards, because we connect with Islamic researcher. It is very interesting, I think. I hope that I come back to Iran many other times.
Of course, we hope the same thing happens, and we'll see you back many times. Thank you so much for your time, Doctor.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for sharing this time with us. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Rai.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to you all. You are tuning to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with Reporters. Reporters from all over the globe tells us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from distant lands. That will be followed by Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. Our radio production's feature will be the next. And our final program this hour is The Last Savior. This program discusses the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. Everything about his government and his life. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
with reporters.
As Israel's deadly onslaught in Gaza continues, any notion of a ceasefire exists in name.